Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and today is a pre-recorded show, our 23rd episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific on August 8th, 2015. Today, we are joined by Witch, teacher and author Gede Parma, who is author of such incredible books as Ecstatic Witchcraft, By Land, Sky, and Sea, and Spirited. And it's amazing because he's in his 20s and has published three incredible books on witchcraft and paganism, and is actually joining us today from where he is currently living in Bali, Indonesia. And before we get to him, we're going to be starting today's episode, as we do every week, with a section from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World. 365 prayers, poems, and invocations for honoring the earth. And today's prayer is actually a Hawaiian prayer, which reads, "May the earth continue to live. May the heavens above continue to live. May the rains continue to dampen the land. May the wet forests continue to grow. Then the flowers shall bloom, and we people shall live again." So without further ado, here is Gede. Gede, are you there?
I am.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. I get the pleasure of seeing you when I'm in New York. I get the pleasure of seeing you at least annually. But it was, you know, you entered my life. I think it was really perfect timing. It was really just when I was really moving to the city and, you know, from Long Island and beginning to get introduced to the amazing people who, if you know, obviously don't live here, but who've helped shape, I've had a huge hand in New York witchcraft. And I don't know, do you realize that you've had a huge hand in New York witchcraft?
Not particularly. I mean, people have told me some interesting things, but, you know, I live very far away and New York always seems so surreal to me. So,
I mean, Even for us who live here, it's surreal. So I am in no way surprised, but, you know, between Dylan Henley and Courtney Weber, you know, definitely, you're someone who helped mark this space for me, so I thank you for that. So maybe we'll just get started with, where are you in the world?
Well, right now, I'm in just outside of Ubud in Bali, which, if people don't know where that is, that's in Indonesia, in the southern hemisphere. Well, it's super close to the equator, though, so I kind of consider it almost equatorial. But that's where I am. And I travel a lot, though. Like every 4 to 5 months, I also travel for like plots of three months at a time, usually in North America or Australia.
Yeah, I didn't. You know, I'm looking at your website and all of the amazing classes that you're teaching this upcoming fall. I didn't realize that Australia was also really on the map for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I grew up there, and I have a lot of. I have a lot of family and deep friends and initiates and beautiful people in Australia. I love it.
So you grew up in Australia, and would you identify as Australian, or would you identify as a hyphenated Australian?
I have really had a really difficult time identifying with nation states. So I kind of, like, you know, in a casual conversation, if someone asks, "Where are you from?" then I usually have a kind of a stifled answer and an awkward one. So I usually say something like, "Well, I was born in Bali, but I grew up in Australia." Like, and you know, maybe that's not what the answer people are looking for, but I find it really hard to identify with, you know, modern countries, especially like a country like Australia, which is in my mind, an illegitimate country because it's founded on invasion and the conquering of indigenous people. or at least the cruel mistreatment of Indigenous people.
Well, those statements absolutely, are in no way foreign to this podcast. You're in the right place to be to be having such conversations. So let's talk a bit about, if you don't mind us, going into early Gede Parma life. You're born in Bali. Indonesia is definitely not a place on earth I have a lot of historical understanding of, or a knowledge of the ethnic makeup of individuals who live there. Would you identify as Balian, or sort of what would you say is your ethnic heritage? And I ask you this just because I know that this actually plays a role in your spiritual practice and the tradition that you've crafted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, definitely I identify as ethnically Balinese because, that's definitely what I am. And Bali itself is not a country. It's an island, and it's considered a province now within the modern nation state of Indonesia, which is kind of it's a very troubling nation as well. It is relatively recent as well, this nation, in terms of its kind of hegemony and its kind of monolithic reality, because it's the largest archipelago of islands in the world that is now considered, one country. But a lot of these islands in this giant archipelago of islands are completely different in terms of culture. So even though this is, I think it's the fifth or the fourth most populous nation in the world, it's also the most populated Muslim country in the world. But where I live in Bali is a Hindu majority island. And in some ways, culturally and historically, it's almost near impossible as to how that stayed this way, because Indonesia, for a long time before Islam arrived here, was a Hindu empire, was the Majapahit Hindu empire. And before that, of course, it was, every region, bioregion, island, culture was connected to its own, spirit working, animistic, probably polytheistic, very, very indigenous rootedness. And a lot of that still is held in even the islands that are Muslim, especially as you head away from metropolitan areas, you'll find a lot of old spirit working and shamanistic practice going on. It's a really complex country. It's got some of the most biodiverse, it's some of the most biodiverse in terms of landscape and geography and ecology, and in terms of like the ocean and the coral reefs, it's for diving, it's apparently meticulous and wondrous. I haven't done it, but I've heard from some people who are really in the know that that's the case. Also, the Wallace Line, which I'm fascinated by, is drawn between Bali and Lombok. So where I'm living is exactly the end of Asiatic flora and fauna, and the island to our east is the beginning of Australasian flora and fauna. And so there was a scientist called Wallace who articulated that theory, that line, that observation. And so I'm living in Bali means one is on the edge of animals and plants that are typically can be found in other parts of Asia. And just across the strait is animals that are typically found in Australasian parts of the world, like Papua New Guinea, etc. So it's a pretty interesting place.
Well, I imagine it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, even just hearing the things that are going on behind you, it sounds, we don't have that many, birds alone. You definitely don't hear them on my end of things. But yeah, that's we're coming to visit is pretty much what I'm saying. Langston,
yeah, you would love it.
I guess before we get into the Wildwood tradition and the reclaiming tradition and other traditions and modalities that have really fed you and that you've become sort of a part of sharing in the world, I know that you grew up with certain spiritual practices. Can you speak a bit to who brought you up with them and what were they?
Yeah, and that's become much more pointed, actually, you know, living in Bali. I've only lived in Bali for, like, just over a year and a half now, so living here has helped me contextualize them more. But so my father and his parents, both of his parents, but especially his mother, are involved in very much what I would call traditional animistic Balinese healing and mediumship, divination and magic. My father is a very like devoutly Hindu person. Except if you talk to him, you know, he's still Hindu, of course. He's a Shivayat. His main god or soul god, as I would call it, is Siwa or Shiva. He has paintings of him everywhere, giant murals on the walls, etc. But it, you know, if you talk to him about his day-to-day kind of interactions with the other world or with the spirits, it's very much much more related to beings like what we would in the West call seraphs or angels or shining ones or the fairy people. It's very much about his relationship and his visionary gnosis and law-filled kind of lineaged connection to these beings. Like, I remember asking him when I was about 11 or 10 once when I was visiting Bali, because we visited every year, even though I grew up in Australia. I remember asking him about fairy people, and I had to translate a bit because, of course, he had no idea what I was talking about. So I said, oh, they look like this. You know, I was saying they can be quite tall and majestic, and they seem to shine and you know, they seem to be luminous. I was specifically talking about like the gentry or the she folk that I was familiar with from kind of Celtic Britain. And he started going, oh, yeah, no, I totally know what you mean. We call them jinn, which is obviously an Arabic word that has kind of been kind of absorbed into the Balinese and Indonesian folklore as a word referring to shining beings in the land. And I think originally that's probably what it meant for pre-Islamic, you know, Arabia as well. But he was talking about these jinn beings as being very luminous women. He specifically spoke about women who would dance in the moonlight and were quite tall and were very fond of our family. And he spoke about one of his cousins being abducted and taken into the jungle and never being seen again. And he just said it all very matter-of-factly. And many stories like that formed my early years, stories of sort of very matter-of-fact straightforward stories about spirits and fairy abduction and different stones and their properties saving you from death or poison or malevolent magic. A lot of my father's kind of day-to-day work is about protection from malevolent magic and warding from malevolent magic. That's kind of on his mind often. I used to think it was paranoia, but now I know it's not. So those were the things that formed my early kind of mind. And also my grandmother, my Dadong, my Balinese grandmother, she was very renowned in the surrounds of where she lived on one of the sacred mountains here, one of the potent volcanoes that's still active in Bali, called Gunung Batur, where my father's family is from. And she had a tiger spirit, which she passed to me in 2011. But she died as humans know death, and when I was two. But her presence lingered not just for me, but kind of for the whole egregore of my Balinese family. And so she would come through in life. She was a vessel for the spirits and would take spirits in. She would also nurse people who had been possessed in extreme ways and heal them back to kind of, you know, equilibrium. And she knew how to divine, and she knew how to interpret dreams, and she went into trance very easily. So, you know, and she shapeshifted into tigers, and all of this is kind of like a folklore in my family, but very much rooted in general fact, because anyone who visits Bali at all, any, you know, and who you know, moves away from the airport and the kind of the tourist zone around the airport will realize how animistic and how spirit-led the Balinese people are, and how magic is very much interwoven and also considered a science and a specialty, and that certain people are predisposed to it and certain people have that fate. And that's how I understand myself too, that I've inherited that red thread from my family, and that I express it differently because I was raised in the West and I also am half of, you know, European descent. So I have to take that seriously too. And that's been a big part of my life. But it's been very orienting for me to have been exposed, well, not even exposed, just immersed in this world that's, you know, super real to me. And I think that's probably how, if I'm being objective about my life and my work thus far, like I just turned 27, and I think that's how I have been. It's been so simple for me to understand spirit work because it was there from when I can, you know, remember, in a very overt way, so not even a hidden way.
Oh, that makes total sense, especially to grow up with family stories and family, not just family stories, family energies, and, you know, to be returning, as you say, annually to this place where the land spirits are alive and active and working with the people in still such an intimate way, as it seems, you know, you're sort of saying. I guess, you know, we're hitting a terminology conversation. I guess when you're talking about fey folk, you're in a way talking about land spirits and nature spirits.
Sorry, what was your question?
So I guess when you're talking about fey folk, I translate that to be sort of land spirits and nature spirits.
That's a contentious issue. I mean, you know, generally I would agree with you. And I would also say that when I am speaking about the fairy people, I'm talking about... my experience with the fairy people, like I work very closely with two fairy beings in particular, who, you know, who I would also call elves in like the Germanic kind of cultures, they would have been known as elves. They're kind of the people, they're related to legends around the fallen angels. Like in traditional witchcraft, which I practice, we have these legends around how we inherited the cunning fire, which is that the bright ones of heaven rebelled, or there was a problem in the matrix, or, you know, or just that the great angels, the seraphs of heaven looked down and saw the daughters of man and saw beauty and art and potential for great, great power. And so they unified their heavenly celestial fire with the fire indwelling in the earth. And they married and they formed the first witch houses. So that is a story that we tell, and it is very much covered by a veneer of popular Christianity. And that is, you know, if you look at the kind of what is left, and actually remarkably a lot is left of the fairy faith of Europe. But if you look at what the people are saying in the various local cults of the fairy faith, in Europe, we find people talking about beings who have their own code of conduct, their own kind of their own court systems in terms of how they relate to each other. They seem to be like the angels who live in the earth, whether they fell in the idea that like this planet is itself a congealed or you know the process of a dead supernova star. You know, we are made of stars. All of that beautiful poetry. The fairy people are like a link between the highest starry celestial upperworldly realms and the, you know, the deepest underworldly realms, and they seem to be like the mediators, the great and wise and inspiring mediators. Like I find the fairy people endlessly mysterious. So yes, they have a deep kinship, or could even be considered to be land spirits, and they seem to be. And, you know, to say fairy is such a nebulous thing as well, but the beings that I'm specifically talking about seem to have their own kind of a little bit of their own agenda within that. So they exist kind of mediating between the upper realms and the lower realms and the middle realms, and that they seem to be also the great, my friend and mentor Lee Morgan would call them potentially conscious fates, and he would also say that the gods are conscious fates. So that's kind of my link there.
So traditional witchcraft from Europe, when did this enter into your practices versus sort of the traditional Balinese experiences that you were growing up with?
Yeah, so when I was about 10, when I was about 10 and 11, I realized I was a witch. Like, I saw, it's kind of when I awakened, if you will. Like, I saw all of this media around talking about witchcraft, like the Harry Potter craze was beginning or burgeoning at that time. I think Buffy was going on. Anyway, there was things going on, but every time I saw the word witch, I'd have this, like, palpitation or, like, huge resonance that went beyond the rational, that went beyond anything, and it was epic. I remember even then thinking, this is epic, this is me, what is this, this word is my key to the universe. I didn't know about Wicca or what that was. I didn't know that there was a revivalist movement. I didn't know about contemporary paganism. I didn't know any of that. I was just like, wow, witch, I'm a witch. And I didn't even at the time link it to my family heritage. I just thought this, you know, it was just so mind-blowing and so suspending. I felt like I was in a constant trance walking around. And then I, you know, realized I was a witch, and the long story short, went through a few kind of revelations, you know, tried eclectic kind of Wicca, no, tried to explore traditional Wicca, no, began to find that there was another, movement within the witchcraft movement, and that was what we broadly call traditional witchcraft. So from about age 15, I really identified with that movement because it seemed to be, you know, I hesitate to say it, but it seemed to have, it seemed to me to feel more like it had roots. Like, it talked about folklore a lot. It talked about the fairy people a lot. It didn't make witchcraft seem like a classical mystery school with more in common with, like, Icean Roman cults and, you know, things like that, which Wicca can sometimes seem to be. And indeed, many early Wiccan authors said that we have more in common with, you know, mystery schools than with folkloric witchcraft. But I was always much more attracted to the idea of the, and the realities of the Sabbat flight and the, you know, and the Gnosis through dreams and the pacts we make with our familiars and all of that, that had always been the poetry and the lore that interested me the most. And that felt like it was mine, that felt like I belonged inside that story. And, you know, and I did. And so that's the, so now, and looking back upon my life, you know, the idea of traditional witchcraft, if someone asked me, you know, where do you find yourself in this, you know, multiplex of interwoven and sometimes conflicting camps, I would say that was my camp. But, you know, I'm also very much a reclaiming witch, and even though that comes from American traditional witchcraft, its roots are in fairy, Anderson Fairy, reclaiming is a different style of witchcraft, and very much I'm also that. So I'm a few things, which I think you can totally grok.
Absolutely, I can grok that. And what I love, the statement of, you know, that's the story I found myself in. I think that that is such a beautiful way of talking about the heartfelt way that people find themselves in traditions. I think that that's what so many people are looking for right now as they traverse paganism and shamanism and witchcraft traditions. They're trying to ask themselves, where's the story that I fit into? And it's not easy. It takes a quieting of the mind. It takes a quieting of the heart. It takes a stillness, really a stillness that's at the heart of all of these traditions. But instead of sort of choosing that stillness, we're often battling information overload.
Absolutely.
And, you know, which also I think that stillness is related so much to the idea of when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Whether that teacher is a human teacher or a tradition or a myth that just sets you going. I obviously am someone also who finds myself at home in a few different traditions, and reclaiming is so intensely close to my heart. I have unfortunately never attended a witch camp, which we'll get into in a second as to what that is, because you have been teaching at witch camps for years. But Starhawk's The Spiral Dance was the first book I ever read that moved me, like shook me to my knees, like really ripped open my idea of what my purpose was and really, I think, what human potential was to experience, to read a book that combined active spiritual practices with environmentalism and social justice was just amazing. And every year I'm always thinking like, I need to do something with that book that I haven't done yet, but something about, you know, whether it's, you know, sort of creating a reading group or a practice group. But I remember even being in my late teens and, you know, hanging out with my friends in the suburbs of Long Island and just sort of being like, hey, we're, you know, what are we doing today? We're not just going to drive around and smoke weed. We're going to sit in my friend's living room and like play a word game, you know, play, you know, a word game, from, you know, from the spiral dance, you know, just sort of explore consciousness and have fun with that. That was, that book was so foundational to me. So even though I've never, had the privilege of really interacting with the reclaiming community, there's something very much about reclaiming that's in my heart. So I guess as a jump off from there, tell us a bit about the reclaiming tradition and the witch camps.
Yeah, I came to reclaiming after I obviously kind of embraced my witch blood, but reclaiming had, like, I'd probably always secretly identified with its ethos and with its purposes. I didn't actually read The Spiral Dance until much later. I was reading maybe, like, the first couple of books that I'd read when I first came to the craft consciously were very academic, I have to say. But when I read The Spiral Dance, I remember thinking, and that also was not the first Starhawk book I read. I think it was Dreaming the Dark or Truth and Dare, which I also just think those are amazing. I remember thinking, wow, this is, you know, she wrote this at a similar age to when I was, to, you know, I'm that age now, but I think she wrote The Spiral Dance when she was 24 or 25. And she was just, you know, obviously, she's obviously, I've met Starhawk a few times now and worked magic in space with her. And she's, you know, she's a genius. And she's also one of the most passionately convicted people I know in the world. And she's been, you know, she's had a hand in initiating and collaborating on this remarkable tradition, which really cannot be assigned to any quadrant, I think. You know, it has the reclaiming tradition itself has had such influence on the contemporary pagan movement and also on the revivalist witchcraft movement that it's hard to even track it. Like, some things which people assume may have come from the Gardnerian diaspora do not. Like, they just come from reclaiming, and maybe if we track it further, it actually might come from Victor or Cora Anderson, or one of the early fairy people. But when I explain reclaiming to people, like, simply put, I go, you know, I say that reclaiming is an Aradian tradition of witchcraft. And what I mean by that is that its whole kick, its whole kind of piece of magic at the heart of what it is very much about seizing our personal sovereignty and connecting with the sovereignty of our kin, of our neighbors, both human and other than human, and restoring justice and reconnecting right relationship. And I really, truly, honestly feel that that is most perfectly heralded in the mythos of Aradia, the kind of the legends of that particular witch and that particular narrative. And I would also usually say that, inspired by one of my dear friends, who's one of the early reclaimers and also a fairy initiate, Gwydion, he always says to me that reclaiming has four roots. And one of those roots is Anderson Fairy, and one of the other roots is ecofeminism. One of the other roots is anarchistic politics, and the fourth root is either called something like the psychology movement or the human potential movement. And that would be, and there's a giant dog, and that would be contested by some, like the latter one especially. Some people say, oh, there's not that much influence from the human potential movement or the psychology movement. But, you know, in my mind there is. There's a lot of stuff in there from those movements. But it's those four roots, definitely, except what reclaiming is now is remarkably diverse. Like, when you find, there are about 20 witch camps in the world, because of the way reclaiming is formed and organized, it's decentralized. All you need to be a reclaiming witch is to celebrate and kind of agree with our principles of unity, which can be found online by looking up reclaiming principles of unity, and practice reclaiming star magic. And I think the transition there is to understand that actually, in my opinion, reclaiming star magic really only transmits in group situations. So I find it hard. It would be hard to practice it alone. One could, but I think reclaiming magic prospers in tribal egregores and group situations, because that's it. That's what it's about. It's about that relationship and connection, and forming human, and also forming really intimate human bonds with one another, which I think can be seen in Starhawk's early work and her anecdotes in those books. So definitely, one could take a book and sit with a group and figure it out, and that would be the cauldron and the nexus by which that would happen. I feel like it would. work less well alone. And I think the other reality that Reclaiming understands is that, you know, it's a storehouse of powerful activists, whether activists in the other world and this world, or with more of an emphasis on this world. Like, when I'm at a witch camp, I'm just blown away at the kind of people that turn up who you would never see at any other pagan gathering, because they're not esotericists. Some of them aren't, and, you know, and so the people I see at like a Reclaiming witch camp or a Reclaiming gathering are some really kick-ass frontline people who work with their witchcraft very privately, and who work their magic behind the scenes, but also on the edge and on the front, you know, right up there liberating non-human beings or confronting powerful oppressive forces in these systems that seem to rule the world. So that's why I love Reclaiming.
Well, absolutely. Reclaiming, as a tradition, is... there's no separation between the conversation that this tradition is excited about you having between yourself and the spirits, and between yourself and your life, whether that be the relationship that you're in, or the relationship that you're in with, you know, with your land and your home. The way you put it, this place that both is about personal sovereignty and also the sovereignty of your kin. I think that was an excellent way of putting what attracted me to this tradition, and this, you know, this ethos, as you said. And definitely, I would imagine that the people who would be coming to California, you know, to the witch camps, which, you know, now that we keep saying it, I'm like, ooh, that sounds a little scary. So the witch camps, you know, would be, you know, possibly people who might not be excited about other kinds of magical festivals, but at, you know, such a gathering, they know that they're going to be fed and will be feeding others, in a way that's related not only to their own personal well-being, but societal transformation. So, what are some of the workshops that you've taught at a witch camp, and how long does a witch camp last? Can you give us a quick breakdown?
So witch camps are hugely different from like the average kind of pagan festival, because a witch camp is an intensive, so it's they tend to be very structured and actually highly organized. So what they are, they can be, you know, at minimum they're about, some starting witch camps actually begin about 3 nights. Many of them are 4-night or 5-night, but the California camp is a 7-night camp. I think it's the only 7-night camp that's left. British Columbia witch camp might be a 6 or a 7-night camp. I can't actually remember. But what happens at a witch camp is essentially that it's a cauldron. It's a demarcated and suspended space and time in which reclaiming and reclaiming interested people go to go through an intensive, a serious, magical, political, emotional, mythic intensive. So some of the core elements that are required to make this work is usually a teaching team. So these are a group of reclaiming trained teachers. So I came into reclaiming about 5 years ago in terms of my group involvement. And so I came in very, you know, I taught at the first Australian Reclaiming Witch Camp, and my entrance into reclaiming, as it is into many things, was through teaching, because that's a really strong thread in my soul story. So people who don't have, you know, so you can't just go into reclaiming and just start teaching without being reclaiming trained, because it's a particular style and ethos. So I went through 3 years of reclaiming student teaching, and now I'm considered a reclaiming full teacher in the witch camp system. So when you go in, you have to teach in, well, it's highly culturally encouraged that you teach in pairs. So you never teach alone. It's about modeling shared power and early feminist process. And a lot of early feminist processes are woven into the way we meet in groups. So there's always a myth or a story or a theme that overarches the camp's magic. So people know why they're going to that particular camp that particular year. So, for instance, this year at one of the Australian camps, the myth that overarched the whole of the camp was Dionysus. So people already know, okay, so this camp's magic is going to have to do with him, but not just him, and that god or that multiplex being that we call Dionysus, but also there's a general intention, like a magical purpose why people are turning up, and that was all about, that particular theme was all about rising up in our wild tribe and liberation and justice, and also, you know, tearing apart what doesn't serve and making room for that which is of our deepest wealth. And so this year, I wasn't at California Witch Camp this year, but they worked with the story, or it worked with them, of Baba Yaga and the Vasilisa. So actually, reclaiming avails itself of a great cornucopia of worldly wisdom, and this can be quite contentious, which is another issue we could probably get to later. But in my experience, is hugely intelligent and intuitive. And so we go knowing that there's a mythic story holding the whole container. You know, the first ritual circle is cast, and it's considered up and working for the whole of the time, and it doesn't come down, or it's not unraveled until the last day. So that whole, you know, we are between the worlds together psychologically, etherically, or on all levels at all times when we're in that intensive space. And then what happens is that the teaching team, whether it's 6 or 10 or 8, usually the numbers, breaks off into those pairs, and they have prepared over the year or the 6 months before the camp actually happens, they prepared a path. And what that path is it's like an intensive that is offered every morning for 3 hours. So usually there are 4 to 5 sessions that occur over that week, or over those 4 days, usually 4 sessions. And basically material and experience is facilitated and transmitted and anchored by at least 2 teachers. And this could be, you know, there have been literally thousands of paths now offered at witch camps, and it's highly encouraged. The cultural protocol is you go to witch camp to, you know, it's a boot camp for witches. You go to do this stuff. You go to flex your magical muscles. You go to engage your mind. You go to learn skills that can be of use in this middle world. So the emphasis is highly on how do we translate these magical and sometimes highly esoteric skills into being of purpose, you know, in the middle world, in our shared collaborative consensus realm or whatever. So, you know, I've personally co-taught paths that have to do with aspecting, or that's what we call possessory style invocation. I've taught paths that have to do with artistic tribal mind and how we break down the barriers between us and work with intimacy and still have boundaries and talk about sovereignty and experience sovereignty and art and take that out into the world. I've recently, last year I was in British Columbia and I co-taught a path about joy and about immersing in joy and how that itself is a political act and a spiritual, you know, prayerful devotion to self. So there's so many different things that the teaching team or the facilitation team can work with. And then every night, what is happening is that there's a ritual, a ritual every night or most nights that works with that theme. So we invoke and travel to those gods or those spirits, and we work with themes that the teaching team or the facilitation team has, you know, been inspired by. There are these three long meetings usually before a witch camp begins, where the teaching team gathers for 12 hours every day and painstakingly and joyously immerses in the myth in magical and pragmatic ways, and begins to figure out the arc, so the ritual arc of that week, and how to facilitate the camp through the magical purpose, which may be group initiation, which may be how do we work with our rage and break through our despair and come into a place where we are prepared and capable to be change makers. These are the types of things that we do.
Can we take a second and just sidetrack to joy as a political act?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that this is something that is, it's something that I feel very much needs to be my banner right now in terms of the atrocities that are happening in the world and the pain that we're experiencing around them. You know, the pain that those of us who, you know,
are either don't have the privilege to be apathetic or have found our way out of, you know, have clawed our way out of the grips of apathy. Because if you're paying attention, then you're enraged. Mm. And a lot of people, I think, are wondering right now, what do I do with this rage and anger besides direct it at those who I feel are, you know, the culprits here? And I absolutely understand that. You know, I was actually saying a lot of this just about a lot of this in my last podcast that took place last week. And I guess my banner is make sure that you are making room for joy. Make sure that, because you didn't come here to be angry, actually. Yeah. Like you came here with a purpose, and when you find that purpose and are living that purpose, you're going to be experiencing joy. And you came here to live that purpose and experience that joy. And that purpose is needed now. That purpose isn't a sideline. That, you know, that whether that is a passion for photography or, you know, your soul's purpose, part of it is supposed to be teaching young children. This isn't a sideline to the atrocities that are happening to the, you know, speaking as an American, to what happened recently to the young black woman, Sandra Bland, who was pulled over in Texas, or to the most recent mass shooting in America in Louisiana, that our soul's purposes, especially if we chose to incarnate at this time, are actually supposed to be an antidote.
Yeah.
To these atrocities. Our soul's purposes and joy are not a distraction from the work at hand. They are the work at hand. And I love that Witch Camp is a place that fosters such a conversation in community. Because the other thing I strongly believe is that our soul's purposes can't be fully realized outside of community.
Absolutely.
So reclaiming, but that's not where you stop, because then there's the Wildwood tradition. So can you give us a bit of information about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much, you know, that's my home tradition. It's my most beloved, my beloved tradition, in the sense of, like, you know, that it, of all places, that's where I, you know, that's where my joy is, if we're going to use that word. And I just did. But so that, you know, my involvement with that tradition currently is still very active. I still very much am a mentor and a teacher to those that I teach that tradition to. It's much more private, or it's gotten that way. I mean, certainly I've mentioned it in the books that I've published, but I've never mentioned much lore. And we have quite the vast kind of storehouse of lore. And what is really interesting is that we've never contrived a history. Our history is very straightforward, and perhaps this is the history of many revivalist traditions, is that we all knew we were witches, which is, you know, for me, a phenomenon that occurs in the human psychology and the human ecology. Every now, you know, so many people are going to be born that way, right? And so we find our families, and we train each other, and we are trained by the spirits, and we make our covenants. And this is very much how Wildwood began, in the sense that we converged about 10 years ago, a group of four young queer male-bodied people on a very sacred and powerful mountain in Queensland in Australia, and we had a mission. And that mission was not to found a tradition, because that wasn't in our conscious minds. We wanted a coven in which to seriously practice our craft, because we did not feel welcomed by traditional Wicca, and we did not feel welcomed by the kind of older groups around in terms of age. You know, we were 18 at the time, most of us. And I can be hugely serious. That's a big part of who I am, and I'm a hugely devout person, and maybe that comes from my family. But what happened was we started to tap into real forces, as you do when you're practicing the craft. And those forces did not just speak to us. So what I have discovered since many times, especially when speaking to traditional witches of different houses and lineages, is I've you know, what was originally, you know, what we would call unverified personal gnosis, or, you know, we were all having it, so it was a kind of a fourfold gnosis, turned into what we would now call also peer corroborated gnosis, which in my other linkages, both in lineaged terms and in social and conversational terms with other witches, has not just been peer corroborated gnosis, but very much, oh, yeah, this is this, and this comes from here. So very much being able to track a lot of our lore. And my particular fascination and eternal kind of obsession with witchcraft has created a huge ability for me to know what needs to be in our tradition and what doesn't. And it's been a very organic process. It's not like, oh, I'm going to put this here and shove it there. So at the core of Wildwood is very much this cultus around the sacred four, which are these four witches gods, who, you know, we call them various names, and they have, you know, private names that are passed at initiation. But we have Grandmother Weaver, who is Old Fate, who is all things and nothing and the void of chaos and all potential. And we have Grandfather Green Man, who is the bones of the earth, who is Lord Time, who is the king of life and death itself. And then we have the two that maybe more modern witches are familiar with in terms of, like, archetype. We have the, sometimes we call her the Crescent Crown Goddess or the Rose Queen or Our Lady, and she very much has an inner name that we know. And she is the Witch Mother. And then we have the Witch Father or the Master or the Prince of Paradise, the Horned Cloaked God. And we also have other families of spirits that are deeply significant to our mythos, and that is all worked behind curtains, you know, so to speak, so we don't really talk about that. But essentially, what we are is comparable to, you know, the Anderson Fairy tradition. We have a lot in common with that tradition, and comparable to other, you know, old craft traditions. Our work is varied. We do a lot of spirit flight work. We do a lot of possession work. We do witchy shit.
the best way to put it.
Yeah, like I'm like, what else to say? You know, in some ways it's highly unique, but in other ways it's just essential classical witchcraft. But yeah, we do. I guess the difference between any witchcraft tradition is usually what. Spirits and familiars and gods is that particular witch house or witch tradition in covenant with. I think that's where we draw our lines. But even then, those lines are only drawn in the sand, because if you go under that in the underworld, we all realize, oh, you know, these are primal gods who exist before the idea of named cultural gods. Like Orion Foxwood speaks of his main mentor, Lady Circe, speaking that witches venerate the gods who made the... Oh, God, how does that quote go? It's so amazing, and I'm fucking it up. It's witches... The gods of the witches are those who made the gods that man worship. Something like that, right? So basically, the gods that witches are venerating are the beings that are behind the named cultural gods. But we can kind of... we can interact to them through the named cultural gods, for sure. And those named cultural gods, I'm doing quotes in the air right now, are very much beings, of course. So I'm not trying to say they're not, because I definitely venerate many of them. But does that make sense? Do you want me?
No, absolutely. It does to me. I know that might be a sort of a new concept for some people. And you know, and I feel like that the conversation gets even broader, you know, because for some people, gods are not, you know, gods are archetypal beings, and that's not a that's not a school of thought that is for me. But that's where some people are. You know, definitely. When it comes to polytheism, it takes all kinds kind of a time period. But what you just said makes perfect sense to me. Okay.
Wake me up, electric. Take me in your sounds, truly so eccentric. Your feet never touch the ground, me darling. I've been so bad acting rowdy, charming. You make me have super sexual feelings, thinking I'm in love. My heart pumped up through the ceiling like Cupid struck me at your touch, me vicious. I wasn't born yesterday, it's so delicious. The taste of innocence stripping away. Strip it away.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network. whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances, contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Wednesdays from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Is Wildwood an initiatic tradition?
Absolutely, yeah. It very much is. Our body of initiates is small. It's about 30 people. And interestingly, maybe, you know, I think I could link it very much to my traveling. We do not initiate from distance. There's no initiation from distance. Those people who I am mentoring, I have all met physically. I have friendship relationships with these people. I live in Bali currently, but I travel a lot. So I currently have students in North America and Australia and Amsterdam, and I have about there's a body of about 10 current aspirants is what we call them, and we don't have degrees. We don't originate in a Wiccan lineage. We're not interested in that aesthetic. But what we do have is we have aspirants, we have dedicants, and we have initiates. But a dedicant is an initiate in every sense of the word, in terms of like dedication being the first ritual where someone is admitted or brought in lovingly and daringly into the what I call the Rose House, but what is more commonly known as, you know, the inner court. So, you know, certain names and stories are passed at that time. Certain, corpi of law, bodies of law are passed at that time for the new initiate to work with. And then we have a different style of initiation that people can feel drawn to after that, which is much more kind of, we call it the firebrand mysteries. It's much more related to fully marrying the tradition, and also the wild wood, which to us is the witch's other world or the witch's heartland. An actual place that we travel to in soul flight and ecstasy, and you know, it's the depository of all our wisdom. So we marry that within ourselves, and then we in some way become actively engaged with passing and transmitting it. So there's the general initiation, and then there's the initiation for those who feel very much faithfully and passionately drawn into the idea of transmitting that tradition.
So well, that's how we... please continue.
That's it.
Well, for anyone who is sort of thinking, you know, so many traditions, what I want to say is what I think is so beautiful is that you're actually giving homage to these traditions, that you're saying, this is where I come from, that these are actually established places and established roads that people have walked, that I too have walked, that have informed my personal worldview, because out of these, we have all of these beautiful books that even though, you know, you are coming out of, sort of Balinese shamanic practices and tradition, you know, reclaiming witchcraft in America, your books are so you. There is, you, what you have written, no one else on earth could write. And they are just tomes that speak to someone who has truly walked not just a path of skill, but a heartfelt path, a deeply, deeply heartfelt path. I would say that, you know, your heart, in my experience of your writings, it is so obvious that it's your heart that has been the vehicle that has led you to the places that you have gone. And I don't just mean the earthly places, obviously. And you've, you know, obviously, you know, kudos to Starhawk for writing The Spiral Dance, age 25. You're just about to turn 27, and you've written three books and have a fourth coming out this upcoming February. Of the three books of yours, which would you say is so? Where would you suggest that someone start?
Well, I guess it depends what they're interested in. You know, like witchcraft is not for everyone. But if they are interested in witchcraft, then I would very much say to read Ecstatic Witchcraft. You know, and it's interesting. I've pondered it since. You know, that book came out in 2012. I obviously wrote it in 2010 and 2011. But so that's, you know, 5 years ago, and a lot has changed in me, but I still look at that book and go, yes, this is a book that I would gladly say, read this book, because it, you know, it gives you cosmology and philosophy and some of the more applicable and accessible technique in order for you to find the roads to your own soul story. So that you can figure out, you know, which are the spirits that you are in covenant with or that you are aligning with, and what skills do you feel predisposed to, and which skills are your growing edges, and how do you want to be a witch? It's basically kind of the mission of that book. And you know, my second published book, I wish had come out after my third published book, because actually it makes much more sense in that context. It's like a compendium of notes that if someone had read Ecstatic Witchcraft and then they read By Land, Sky, and Sea, they would go, oh, I get this now, because this can all like slot in here. So it's like a compendium of notes, like field notes around different techniques. And very much like I would look at that and go, oh, yeah, that's a really, you know, the word eclectic is contentious, and I really don't like to go near it. But it's like, oh, yeah, that's a very eclectic book, but it makes sense in the context of the Ecstatic Witchcraft book. And then Spirited, I recently reread because I wanted to know what I was like when I was 16, because that book came out in 2009, but I started writing it when I was 16, and I think it's 366 pages long, but it used to be half, like the original manuscript was like twice that size. And I remember submitting that to Llewellyn and being like, I want this to get published, but whatever. And the acquisitions editor at Llewellyn was very much like, oh, we love this book, but it's huge. Can you, like, you know, you repeat yourself often. Can you, like, cut it down? And I went, okay. So I went through and cut down the repetitions, and I cut out a whole chapter. And it came to the size it is in. So that was a really good lesson in editing and succinctness for me, which probably I still struggle with because I love prose poetry. But you know, I really look at Spirited and then I go, wow, this is a really, it's not a book that's about witchcraft per se. It's a book about contemporary paganism, but specifically I call it now my transition between kind of neo-paganism into my practice as a witch. So if anyone out there who, especially in, you know, North America, which is hugely where the neo-pagan movement began, I feel, in the way we know it today, like, if anyone is touched by that, you know, and is desiring a place to explore, then they need to probably, I would suggest they read that book so that they can figure out how to extend into a different thing. You know, not saying that neo-paganism is wrong, but I feel like it doesn't exactly present one the way into personal practice that is grounded in technique or like legitimate connection with the spirit world necessarily. I feel like it's a movement, a cultural movement, and an ethical movement, and a mythical movement. And Spirited for me is a book that is about transiting from that into a grounded practice.
Well, I would say that makes perfect sense. You know, sort of the conversation of moving from an identity based place with these practices to a practice based place with the practices. I know that transition and where and when that happened in my own life. What is the book that's coming out that you're releasing to us this upcoming February?
Yeah, that's about the Iron Pentacle, which is a book, which is a concept and a tool that is used and worked with in the Anderson Fairy tradition and the Reclaiming tradition. And obviously it came into Reclaiming through Anderson Fairy because Starhawk was one of the early fairy initiates. So Iron Pentacle, it, like, simply is a tool about reasserting and reclaiming and revivifying one's essential and right relationship with five fundamental forces, which one of the mighty dead that we now venerate, an early liturgist and initiate of the fairy tradition, Gabrielle, he spoke of as a witch's kind of ethical directive. So the points are sex, pride, self, power, and passion. And in Reclaiming, we very much embody this. So sex is in the head, pride is in the right foot, self is in the left hand, power is in the right hand, and passion is in the left foot. So we literally embody that in the spread eagle pentagram that the human body makes, and we run the life force from head to foot to hand to foot to head. And we explore those themes and those points in our lives where we're stuck with them, where we need to move energy and reclaim pieces that we've lost in the style of shamanic soul retrieval, in the style of personal process, in the style of hypnosis. You know, it's an open book. In terms of the Anderson Fairy tradition, there's much more private lore that is attached to that tool. Reclaiming is very much considered an open source tradition, so it's taken that magic in a different direction. But the book we've written, of course, is not an Anderson Fairy book. It's a reclaiming book that I co-wrote with another reclaiming priestess, Jane Meredith, and it's a book about reclaiming and journeying through those points to come home. Again and again and again, because it's not a work you can just be done with. Anyone who's touched the Iron Pentacle knows that this is the work of a lifetime, and that's exactly the, you know, I'm just taking that quote from Victor Anderson because that's what he said, that it's the work of a lifetime, so it doesn't stop.
No, it doesn't, and I do have some experience working the Iron Pentacle, and I would say in my experience it's a form of shadow work. Which anyone who is excited about, you know, wielding witchcraft power, shamanic power, etc., should know that, you know, this is such work is primary. Such work is incredibly necessary, because self-knowledge is incredibly necessary. That, you know, these kinds of wielding these practices with consciousness and skill comes at a cost, and that cost is a huge part of that cost is know thyself. And it's a beautiful self-knowledge tool in my experience. So I'm thrilled that you're writing about it, because my own book, Deliverance, which came out in May and is sort of looking at healing and uncrossing in and protection in Southern conjure and African American folk magic really puts asterisks around the word healing. And obviously the, you know, Anderson Ferry tradition, you're not going to find Southern conjurers practicing Anderson Ferry tradition necessarily in South Carolina or in Georgia, but I did do my best to emphasize that these blind spots in our lives need attention. We need to ask spirit, hey, help me to look at this. And each of those points on that iron pentacle are so potent, even just to say them out loud. It's like, wait, all of those things at once, I have to look at them? Pride, power, passion, sex? But we must, especially in a world where each of those are so distorted.
Yeah.
Such as, you know, our introduction to these energies and how these energies are sort of repeatedly fed back to us are often through such a distorted lens that finding our way back to personal sovereignty with them is such an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the work of the Iron Pentacle. Like, that's, you just summed it up right there.
Thrilled.
So much about that style of work is about getting right with yourself. And constantly coming back to that, you know, whether you call it core wealth or authentic self or, you know, sovereignty or self-possession or self-knowledge, it's about getting right with yourself. And we have to be right with ourselves in order to be right with the world and with our, you know, our partners in magic, our communities. And that is a constant, you know, a constant return and a constant work. And I think another really powerful strength of the Iron Pentacle is that it's a diagnostic tool. Is that, you know, if we as witches require these 5 points to be, you know, working, then in order to make our magic and to do our spirit work and to commit to our sorceress endeavors and all of that, then we need to really be able to diagnose and discover and reveal to ourselves where we are not in balance, where we're not in right relationship. And that can be really fucking hard and difficult. And it can also be wonderful and liberating and rapturous and often all of those things at the same time. Like, the Iron Pentacle work is huge. And, you know, it's not safe. And I will also say that writing any magic, any true magic, isn't safe. So on, you know, it's going to be. I obviously know that it's considered contentious already. There's been some contention around it being published already, even though it's certainly coming out. So that is always going to be the case, because certain people will hold one thing as more dangerous than another, and with great rationale and great conviction and, you know, wonderful opinion and context to have that opinion, and yet my opinion and my context to have this opinion differs. So I know, you know, the publication of this book will be vaguely contentious or majorly contentious, but I think this work is really important to offer to more than those people who know about it through reclaiming and through Anderson Ferry.
Well, in the words of Raven Caldera, 'tis an ill wind that blows no minds. So I'm of course thrilled that it's coming out. And it, you know, just this conversation is reminding me of the conversation I'm having in my head over and over again, which is that, you know, power isn't safe. And power isn't a safe subject, and people want it to be safe. And I'm brought back to, I don't know if you've ever seen the great musical, even in its movie form, Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
I love it. Yeah.
But there's that part where Hedwig as a child is with his mother, and his mother is trying to teach him absolute power corrupts, and sort of leaves him with this absolutely horrific idea, which is, better to be powerless, my son. And, you know, and people, I guess, often feel left between these ideas. It's either absolute power that's coming from outside of oneself, and, you know, seeing how that often is wielded in corrupt ways, or powerlessness versus what do I have to mine to get to my power? What's standing in the way of my power? What's standing in the way of me really wielding my power? And again, as you said, that this is such a powerful diagnostic tool, you know, that needs to be available. And I also love that you said, you know, you referred to reclaiming as an open source tradition, because I'm kind of really geekily obsessed with using technical terms in relation to witchcraft and shamanism. So yes, for open source traditions.
Yeah, well, obviously, I wouldn't be involved. You know, a lot of my witchcraft is actually hugely private. But you know, and that's paradoxical because I'm a writer and teacher of it. But a lot of it is a lot of the law based stuff that I practice is very private. But obviously, I wouldn't be involved in reclaiming if I didn't think it had some great medicine for the world. And you know, also as a place for me, as a place that I feel deeply at home, and I feel deeply at home in it and with the witches of that tradition.
And also what I love is, if anyone goes to your website, which people absolutely should, GedePaRMA.com, is that, you know, on the events page, we see how all of these traditions and practices come together and the medicine that you're bringing into the world. How I wish I could be in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, taking this class, Medean Magic, Legendary Sorcery. So you're bringing innovative new tools from the 21st, you know, from the 20th and 21st century, and combining them with ancient mythic understandings of the world and power, and bringing that to the world. And it's just so wonderful. We are so blessed to have you. Will you be making your way back to the US in the next year?
I will, yeah. So my book comes out. So Jane and my book come out in February, and I will be at Pantheacon. Whether or not, you know, right now is the whole proposal time for Pantheacon, so I can't say for sure whether I'll be there anyway. So
yay!
I can say that for sure. But yeah, so it'll be in the States from the 27th of January until the middle of March, doing my thing again. Yeah, I love coming to the States. It's harrowing to kind of enter that egregore, and it's also blissful because I have so many deep connections with people in the States, so I'm super excited about it.
And I've totally seen you in that state between the harrowing and the bliss, because it says a lot to me, though, about what, I guess, the soup that I live in as an American, the energetic soup that I live in, and as an American and as a New Yorker. I totally get that, but we are always so privileged by your presence here. So, hopefully, you know, we'll be speaking to you before that, you know, before this upcoming Pantheacon, but we'll also hopefully be seeing you at Pantheacon in person.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for being a guest here on the show.
Thank you, Kai.
This has been On Sacred Ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week when we yet again traverse the planet and focus on place mattering. Till then, please keep a candle lit for courage and our times. I will be keeping a light lit in my window as well. Goodbye.